always get asked, are work friends real friends? This is always one of my favorite questions.
Inside the Science of Social Networks, next on A Third of Your Life.
You spend a third of your life at work. We're all about making it better. This is the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast.
Who do you trust at work? Where do you turn for help on a project? Do you make small talk with your coworkers? Workplace relationships have a surprisingly big impact on performance and employee well-being, but many employers still haven't caught on. Welcome to A Third of Your Life. My name is Steve Flamish, and I'm joined by Jessica Methot, an associate professor of human resource management in the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. She also directs the school's PhD program, and she's a distinguished research professor of management at the University of Exeter Business School in the UK. Jessica, you should be handing out scrolls, not business cards. Thanks for making some time in your busy schedule.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've been studying interpersonal workplace relationships and social network dynamics for 15 years. How did you first get interested in this field?
You know, a lot of the research that we do comes from real world experiences. So when I was getting my PhD program, my husband and I owned a few restaurants. And of course, I was looking at the way that our employees interacted through the lens of the research that I was interested in doing. So I became really fascinated by who started to become friends with each other, who would fill in for shifts to help other people, who would ask each other for advice, who was gossiping with each other, and who just didn't like each other. And so I was actually able to do my dissertation research with data from some of our restaurants because it was such a fascinating way to observe how they were relying on each other, how they interacted, how they communicated, and how it might improve the overall environment and climate of the workplace, how we were operating and managing the employees, and just helping us be more effective as restaurants.
Wow. So you took what you were doing as part of your dissertation and you put it into practice in the restaurant and you saw positive results.
Yes, for the most part. Although given that this was about 15 years ago, there was still so much more to learn.
Well, you sent me some very helpful resources to prepare for this episode, including a 2018 Harvard Business Review article by Paul Leonardi and Ashir Contractor. Let me admit, right off the top, I skipped over the graphs with the lines and the little circles. Are those called nodes?
They are called
those are nodes.
They represent actors. Yes. So each little node is an actor in the network. And the lines are intended to visualize how they're interacting with each other.
Well, they look like polymers to me, and I'm no good at chemistry, so I skipped right over those.
A reminder of college days.
Yes. But I read the text, and it was a really good introduction to the topic. So let me see if I understood it correctly. More and more employers are using HR analytics or people analytics to make management decisions, and that's really focused on the individual attributes of the employees, their education, their experience, their knowledge and skills. But relational analytics, how the employees interact with each other, where they get their information, this constellation of social networks in organizations, that might be a better tool, or at least a good complement to people analytics when it comes to making management decisions. And most employers aren't there yet. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And so a lot of where we're seeing this shift is, you know, historically, human resource management and management in general has been really deeply rooted in the idea of human capital. So focusing on each individual in isolation, thinking about how they can maximize and leverage each person's individual knowledge, skills, abilities, competencies to help with talent management. So making sure that we onboard correctly, how do we recruit the right people? How do we train each individual and how do we manage each individual's performance? But in this case, we're starting to see this really big trend in recent years towards this idea of relational analytics or organizational network analysis, where we can focus more on the relationships between each individual. It's definitely increased over the last probably 10 years. We've seen a much larger proportion of organizations complementing people analytics with the idea of relational analytics. And if you were to Google the top 10 trends in human resource management, numbers 1 or 2 will almost consistently be organizational network analysis.
So how do they work? How do employers collect the data for relational analytics? What kinds of data do they collect? Is that the so-called digital exhaust that I've read about? And how do they then analyze that and use it to predict who will be the innovators and who's efficient and how do we improve efficiency and all of that?
So there are two primary kind of buckets or categories of ways that we can gather data on relationships in organizations. So one is an active method. So through active methodologies, we can distribute surveys. We can have employees, similar to the way they would fill out a pulse survey, indicate which relationships they have with other people in the organization. So in this way, it is not anonymous. It is confidential. So we try to remove any identifying information, but we would give, say, a roster, a list of the names of their employees or coworkers in their unit. And we would say, look through this list and indicate who or the extent to which you trust each one of these individuals. Who would you say you're friends with? Who do you collaborate with? Who do you work well with? Who do you dislike? And we can map all these different networks.
I would probably lie on that survey.
Well, right. And so, you know, I get that feedback a lot that, oh, well, how do you know it's accurate? Well, one, we have that criticism for all of the survey research that we do. How do we know anyone's telling the truth about whether they intend to quit or whether they're satisfied with their jobs? So there's always a little bit of error in their reports, but you would be surprised how open people are in wanting to indicate who they like and don't like on surveys. So it's actually pretty surprising the extent to which we can get accurate reports. And we're able to assess, and there have been studies that have been done comparing the accuracy of these survey reports to, say, the frequency with which people actually interact. So in addition to those active means to gather data, there's also passive means. So this would include things like digital exhaust that you mentioned, where we can, say, analyze email exchanges. And if two people or three people exchanged emails with certain types of communication, then we can say, okay, these people have a collaborative tie or they have a tie in this organization, and that can help us map those networks as well.
That's interesting. It reminds me of the last episode we did with Michael Sturman talking about employee monitoring software. I can certainly understand where some employees and perhaps unions would be concerned about privacy. How can employers strike that balance between managing performance and respecting privacy if they're doing this sort of passive monitoring that you're describing?
I think it's important with both active and passive monitoring. I think we have a really high ethical standard for ensuring that we're keeping the integrity and the confidence of the people whose data we are using. And so this is where we, again, try to remove any identifying information. All of this is used to provide feedback at a higher level to say, it looks like there are some bottlenecks here. It looks like we have some potential newcomers who need to be embedded more in the organization. Here's how we might be able to improve onboarding processes. Here's why we might see higher rates of turnover or what might happen if people retire. But it's not intended to isolate any individual person, and we try to prevent any incidents of retaliation based on the information that we're receiving in these surveys.
I'm curious then, if it works so well, if relational analytics can have such a positive impact, why don't we see more employers doing this? Is it simply that they don't know about it? Have they heard about it and they don't believe in it? Or do they find that it's somehow more expensive to do this than regular people analytics?
So one of the reasons that organizations aren't implementing this to the degree that we think would be important or valuable is that there are barriers to entry. So if you decide you want to use a vendor, that costs money. So we have to kind of do a needs assessment. Where do we stand? Where do we need to see changes? And what can we afford to do in terms of making actionable solution-driven or evidence-based changes? I think stepping back, a lot of organizations, to the same extent that they don't implement people analytics, is that they don't really see the value in relational analytics. If we manage our employees well and we think that we're paying them enough, then they should be doing their jobs and they'll be motivated. And we know that that's not really what creates engagement and motivation in organizations, but that's still kind of the persistent viewpoint of some managers and senior leaders. And I also think it's not necessarily that they're not implementing it, but for the organizations that are, they're not necessarily sure what to do with it. And we see this with people analytics as well, as they end up having data, but aren't really clear how to create a dialogue or a narrative to interpret that data in a way that creates actionable change.
Well, let's talk about the networks within organizations even more broadly. Most organizations have a defined structure, but you are interested in the shadow of the org chart. What is that?
We know that organizations are designed to prescribe interactions and communication among employees, right? So a company's formal structure is reflecting how senior leaders believe that work should get done. But we also all know that we don't always stay within those prescribed solid lines in the org chart. We bridge those functional areas and divisions to collaborate, to build trust, to gossip, to become friends, to develop rivalries and offer advice. And so basically, employees are building these shadow networks, these informal constellations of relationships, communication and interaction patterns that ease inefficiencies, help us to avoid bottlenecks in workflow, build climates for psychological safety, improve their well-being. And so these networks also help organizations become more agile and adapt to changes more effectively because these networks aren't bogged down by bureaucracies.
Well, I know there are two broad categories of networks. You've talked to me about task-based and socio-emotional, and you've studied the complications that arise when those two overlap and become a workplace friendship. What are the pros and cons of workplace friendships?
So, you know, friendships largely form out of being in the same place at the same time. So, you know, proximity, frequency of interaction, also having shared interests and similarities. And so this is really convenient when people are co-located, right? It's not surprising that we have to work with people, we are on a team together, and we have to exchange information and we have interdependencies to get our work done. But that we also end up developing friendships with each other. We ask about each other's families. We start to hang out after work. And many offices have strategically designed their workspaces to promote spontaneous interaction, casual collisions like bumping into each other in the hallway or at the microwave. And so pre-COVID especially, they were breeding grounds for friendships to emerge. And I was really interested in understanding what that means in an organization. So if we are relying on our coworkers to get our work done, but then we also not only develop trust, but get to know them personally, learn about their families, learn about their kids, learn about their dogs, what does that mean for how we do our work? Are we able to ask deeper and better questions? Are we more vulnerable to each other? And so in one of the studies that we conducted back in 2016, that got published in 2018, we were looking at networks that overlaid task and friendship networks. So where task and friendship were occurring simultaneously in a network of relationships. And there had been previous research that suggested that people who have more friendships or more friends at work were less likely to quit, were more engaged, were more committed to their work. But we felt like that might not necessarily be the entire story, especially if we were relying on them to get our work done as well. So on the one hand, we did in fact find that people who had more workplace friendships did develop more trust in their coworkers, did get more valuable feedback, were better able to ask deeper questions and get better answers, and were better able to perform their jobs at work. So they knew there were people there they could rely on and people who were invested in them and the outcome of the work to support them. But on the flip side of that, we also found that people who had more of these workplace friendships felt really drained. Should I be focused on prioritizing my friend role, or should I be focused on prioritizing my coworker role? And so this really challenged how people were behaving at work and whether they behaved professionally or whether they gave their friends privileges and favoritism, and also the complexities in, say, rivalry with a friend. And so we saw that they were reporting this made them feel more emotionally exhausted at work as well.
And what do you do if you find yourself competing with your workplace friend for promotion? Or maybe you're in a position where you have to provide feedback and you don't want to give negative feedback because you don't want to hurt your friend's feelings.
So this is always one of my favorite questions because I always get asked, are work friends real friends? And I think these types of experiences at work really show whether they're real friendships or not, but also the fact that we are at work for a reason and the professional aspect of the relationship really needs to lay the foundation for everything else that happens in that relationship. So really prioritizing professionalism. So if you say get that promotion and your friend didn't, and now there's a little bit of tension and you still want to hang out, but now your friend is reporting to you, how do you ensure that you're providing objective performance evaluations? How do you make sure that you're not privileging that friend by giving them better shifts over other people? And so this is where just being transparent and communicative and laying out some of the friendship scripts when something like that happens can become really important. So when I realized that there were these tensions in workplace friendships and people were really feeling torn about the positives and the negatives that come along with workplace friendships, I started to look at the emotions that were implicated in these relationships as well. So if I feel both positively and negatively towards someone at the same time, so this could be, say, protege of mine who I'm really proud of, but also really jealous of, for example, because they could become really successful. One of the really interesting things that prior research had shown is that there are both upsides and downsides to ambivalence. And we found the same in relationships where we feel ambivalently towards someone else. So on the one hand, ambivalence can be really bad for our health. It can be poor for our cellular aging. It can be poor for our cardiovascular health. It can actually be worse to have an ambivalent relationship than to have a purely negative relationship. So if you know you are enemies with someone, you know you can avoid that person or do whatever you can not to work with them and not to interact with them. But if there's someone who you respect, who you like, but who you also feel torn about, then you want to interact with them, but it can be unpredictable. And that's where a lot of the difficulties in having ambivalent relationships come up. But we also find that ambivalent relationships can spark creativity. So they help us ruminate a little bit more, problem solve, think more deeply, be a little more suspicious of the information that we're getting and more vigilant. And so this helps us maybe be on our toes, but also think outside the box and be more willing to take risks. So there's a balance both with respect to well-being and with respect to creativity and performance that we see with these ambivalent relationships.
This topic really resonates with me because I'm thinking of a former coworker from a TV news station. We were both reporters, players on the same team, and every morning when the managers, producers, and reporters would sit around a conference table to decide on that day's coverage plans, she and I would surreptitiously text each other during the meeting and coordinate on how to get out of the stories that we didn't want to cover and pawn them off on the other reporters in the room.
Yes.
But then she would gossip about me and she would complain to the producers and criticize me, and I simply couldn't understand it. I remember thinking it would almost be better if you were just my enemy and that would be easier. That Jekyll and Hyde was very difficult for me to manage, and I'll bet many people feel the same way.
That's exactly right. And we don't want to entirely lose those people from our networks because they provide a unique value. But that unpredictability can create a lot of disadvantages with respect to how we think and behave and feel at work.
Well, even with this complex web of relationships you've been describing, one third of our conversations are simply small talk. We might get snow on Saturday. Did you watch the Giants game? You've studied the impact of small talk, and you found that it is way more significant than we realize. How do you define small talk?
Sure. So small talk is polite, lighthearted, superficial conversation. And so the interesting thing about small talk then is that it has several features that make it unique from other forms of conversation. So one is that it's scripted. So it is polite. It is lighthearted. It follows a predictable script. We kind of know how we're supposed to respond when someone asks us how we're doing. And the important takeaway there is that it doesn't take a lot of effort. It doesn't require any self-disclosure. So we can re-energize through these brief interactions. And that was where I was really interested in starting to study small talk, because having done so many years of research on workplace friendships and thinking about just how much energy they take and how much effort they take to invest and support and reciprocate these interactions and these relationships, there was so many other types of interactions and types of communication that were occurring at work that didn't have that same type of depth. So the fact that it's scripted is one really interesting feature about small talk that we don't capture when we are, say, venting to a friend or gossiping with a friend. And then the other feature is that it's largely spontaneous. So it can occur without being planned. We can bump into someone in the hallway and strike up a conversation. And so these casual collisions, which happened primarily when we were co-located, can really spark creative ideas. They can help us perform better. They can help us realize we were missing something that we can then go back and apply to the work that we're doing.
How does it differ from gossip?
So that's a really key distinction, and we never want small talk to devolve into gossip. So gossip is really idiosyncratic. We have it with a specific person about a third party who isn't present. Small talk is, again, scripted. So we're following this kind of social ritual where I ask how you're doing, you say you're doing fine. I might even ask, hey, how are the kids? And you'll say they're doing well. We can ask for things like news updates. What are you doing this weekend? We can also have really superficial conversations about the weather or about network television or about sports, but it isn't idiosyncratic in any way. It's not necessarily specific to the person who we're having a conversation with, and it is directed to that person. So it creates a co-presence, an energy that's being transferred between the two people that are having small talk. Gossip is behind the scenes, right? It's intended to hide something. It creates suspicion, and it's largely negative in tone. There can be positive gossip. Hey, did you hear about this great promotion that so-and-so got? But largely, it could create a negative environment where small talk just creates and builds rapport.
You did a small talk study right before the pandemic, published in the Academy of Management Journal, and it received a ton of press. I remember the New York Times, Fast Company, Forbes, they all covered it. For that study, you recruited more than 150 people to document their daily interactions at work and how it affected them over a three-week period. What did you find?
So this was really fascinating, again, because we know small talk can be so polarizing and so stigmatizing. We often find that people mistakenly seek solitude. So they want to avoid it at all costs, right? They think, oh, I don't see any benefit. It doesn't make me feel authentic. I don't want to feign interest in someone else's small talk. So I'm just going to put on my headphones and avoid everyone. But in our research, we found that on days people who had more small talk than they normally would, they experienced a boost in mood and energy. So they felt more friendly feelings, more pride, and this increased their pro-social behavior. So the extent to which they went out of their way to help their coworkers, and it also increased their well-being. So the extent to which they were able to recover from stressors at the end of the workday. And so this was really interesting because the way that we studied it, we essentially controlled for personality traits. So we might see someone who says, I'm really introverted. I don't like small talk. That just means their baseline for small talk is relatively low. So let's take an introverted person who doesn't often have small talk. On days that introverted person had more small talk, they felt more energy. They were better able to recover. They engaged in more pro-social behaviors. Now, of course, there's a flip side to it. So if we are at work, and we did this research pre-pandemic with people who were co-located in offices with their coworkers, they also reported that it was distracting. So not surprisingly, you've got your head down, you're doing your work, someone knocks on your door and wants to chat. It pulls your attention away from the work that you're doing, and it made it more difficult to get back into the flow. So we did hear that it created a time famine that somewhat pulled away from their opportunity to engage in more of those pro-social behaviors. But for the most part, it was largely positive.
So if it's largely positive, do you think managers should actively encourage small talk?
So this is one of those questions that I think can be difficult to answer, but requires a balance. So yes, I do think that organizations should encourage small talk, or that managers should encourage small talk. And we were seeing that both pre-pandemic and now with the return to work, we are seeing The implementation of things like space syntax, where consultants can be brought in to design office spaces where it drives the flow or guides people through different parts of the office to connect, to engage and have small talk while not distracting other people who are really working heads down trying to stay in the flow of getting their work done. So very strategic way of designing workspaces. This is not to compare to an open office space design. So that's a completely different and potentially detrimental office space design. We see people in open office spaces who are avoiding small talk because it's loud, there's buzz, they have trouble getting their work done. And so it's really difficult for them to focus. So they completely avoid it by indicating that they're busy or in meetings or trying to find a quiet space. So this isn't necessarily that. It's really trying to be strategic about where people have the opportunity to engage in small talk.
How has small talk changed during the pandemic? And what can managers do to encourage small talk among people who are working from home or maybe splitting their time between home and the office?
So what we witnessed during the pandemic is that we took small talk for granted. So it was something that we experienced but didn't necessarily realize was so important and such a key part of creating the environment that formed our days. And one of the aspects of small talk that was really difficult to recreate was its spontaneity. So when we shifted to remote work so abruptly, we're not just popping on Zoom and hoping that someone else shows up out of nowhere so that we can chat with them. Our interactions, our conversations, our work interactions became very transactional, very planned, and much less discretionary, much more formal. And so the characteristics of small talk are really difficult to replicate in a virtual environment. When we were physically present in a conversation, it creates that sense of we're together. I have this co-presence with someone else who's standing here with me. People feel like they're in the conversation together. And that natural transfer of energy where we can read each other's emotions, that energy erodes in a virtual environment when we're staring at each other on a screen or staring at ourselves on a screen. Also, during the pandemic, chit-chat just wasn't a priority, right? We were all pressed for time. We were experiencing Zoom fatigue. We weren't trying to drag out meetings too long. We had family responsibilities. And the important thing there is that we should recognize how meaningful a little bit of small talk can be in combating social isolation and redressing some of that loneliness. A small connection can make a really big difference. So just pinging someone, doing a brief check-in and saying, hey, I haven't heard from you this week. I just want to make sure everything is okay. And also, one of the interesting things about small talk is that it helps us with transitions. So we very rarely launch into a meeting without having small talk to grease the wheels, right? Small talk is a social lubricant. We have small talk before sales pitches, before negotiations, before interviews, before performance evaluations. We really use it to set the stage for a controversial conversation. It also helped us transition into work. So if we're walking into the building and we run into a colleague, we have a little bit of chit chat before we sit down and do our work. It helps us transition from home to work. But during the pandemic, where we were all working from home, that all blurred together. It was difficult to shift our mindset from home to work as seamlessly. And there were reports of people who would say, get into their cars and drive around when they didn't have their commute just to get back home to be able to make that mindset transition. And so this is where we want to give people the opportunity to say, have a chat on Slack. So create kind of a leisure chat string. I wouldn't necessarily say that the virtual happy hours were effective. We all kind of experienced those and they were pretty awkward. But I do think that things like daily check-ins are helpful, especially from a managerial perspective. We can also assess our own social health. So how am I feeling today? Have I spoken with anyone? Am I feeling particularly disconnected? And how can I reach out? As leaders, we also want to recreate social rituals for our teams. If this is something that we've lost, how can we ensure that we're still creating and building this social fabric and this sense of psychological safety and trust among our team if we're still working remotely? How can we integrate spontaneous conversations into our remote work ecosystem? So set availability times for when others can connect, if they're free, if they're available, if they want to take a break. And so all of these things we've heard are working relatively well.
Should managers build in time at the start of virtual meetings for small talk? Should they actually put that on the agenda?
I do think that these things need to be informal. If you put it on the agenda, we start to experience something called job creep, where now the meeting actually feels like it's starting 10 minutes early and I'm missing an opportunity to have FaceTime with my manager. And so we really want to be able to emphasize, while yes, I think it's an important step and a great way to give people an opportunity to chat with each other and catch up, we never want to make it feel like it's required. If someone wants to join at the time a meeting starts, that is when the meeting should start. We don't want to force them or coerce them into feeling like they need to pop on 10 minutes early.
Well, overall, this does seem like a really good time to be rebuilding our social networks. Research led by Marissa King found that our professional and personal networks shrank by close to 16%, or more than 200 people, during the early days of the pandemic. Our closest relationships grew stronger, but our network of acquaintances, including those at work, grew smaller. What is the harm in that, Jessica? What is the harm in having our network shrink?
I think one of the primary issues that we see as our networks were shrinking due to the pandemic is that we were losing access to a lot of viewpoints. So we don't necessarily only want depth in our network. So depth being the intimacy that we have with our family members and our best friends and people who we know we can rely on. We want to balance that with breadth in our networks. So having a diverse set of acquaintances and weak ties and viewpoints that help us kind of see out into the world. And so we get new perspectives, we get information and access to feedback that we wouldn't necessarily have in our really dense, close-knit group of family members and friends. And so one of the kind of recommendations that I think we were seeing a lot of is to build back our network. So this is a really great way to strategically think about who did I lose, who do I need, and how do I reassess what type of people and what type of resources and support I need in my network. And this is really key because, you know, there's a lot of pushback about this idea of networking and what it means. And, you know, there's a lot of myths around networking that we want to try to bust because it really is critical to have the right people in our network for different types of support. And so one of the things that we hear is that networking feels dirty, right? That it's immoral, that it's inauthentic, that it's disingenuous, that we're just connecting with people to ask them for things, to get something from them. And I always like to say, you know, it doesn't have to be used that way. Our networks, we can build our networks by giving back. Is there someone who you can help, where you can give and provide support? And that also adds to extending your acquaintance group in your network.
Do you feel encouraged? Do you think we're going in the right direction? Do you think organizations are going in the right direction and taking these things seriously, especially coming out of the pandemic?
I think there is a really important balance here. So we are seeing organizations who aren't necessarily heading in the right direction with these return to work strategies. So some of them are just saying, we all need to be back to work. All of us need to be back to work because we all do our work better when we're present and we can monitor you, playing off of your episode with Mike Sturman. But I think if we can emphasize the benefit of these networks and the value that we get of being co-present in an office, but also giving employees what they now recognize is the flexibility and the autonomy that they need in their work. So having a hybrid work schedule where they get the opportunity to, you know, meet with their team in person, but not requiring 5 days a week of FaceTime, I think is really important. And I do think that organizations, many organizations, are acknowledging that balance as a really critical touch point, but some are just saying, no, we have to all be back at work. I also think we have to be careful of the companies that are saying, okay, let's all stay remote. Because if we don't acknowledge how important these networks of relationships are, then we might lose touch and we might not be creating the climate that we want to embed people in that social fabric.
This is all really interesting. I'm so glad that we touched on all these different topics. And if our listeners want to know more about this, there is a place where they can go to find out more information. I'd like to wrap up with a plug for the website you co-founded. What is workties.org and what can we find there?
Sure. So I'm really excited about this initiative I launched with some colleagues of mine, and we also have a team of PhD students who are supporting it as well. So workties.org is a curated site for all the research that we do on the science of workplace relationships. So we have experts who've published research on relationships at work, the idea of high quality connections and building and boosting these positive relationships at work, how we can manage remote work relationships in a remote environment, how we can use relationships to help us transition into retirement or other career transitions. So it's a really interesting initiative, a really exciting initiative. And this is a website that anyone can visit. You can also find us on LinkedIn and Twitter. And you can find digested, curated posts, blog posts that are written by us and by other guests and experts who do research in this area.
WorkTies.org. Jessica Methot, Associate Professor of Human Resource Management in the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations, thank you so much for being on the show. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much for your time. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to A Third of Your Life, the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations podcast. For more information on our academic programs, faculty, and research, visit smlr.rutgers.edu.